Subcommittee will come to order. Kaylee, will you please call the roll?
Chair Beleka?
Here.
Vice Chair Moraitis?
Here.
Representatives Ahern?
Here.
Bracey?
Here.
Diaz?
Here.
Hager?
Here.
Jones?
Here.
McGee?
Here.
Metz?
Here.
Pasadomo?
Here.
Saunders? Spano?
Here.
Stone?
Here.
Thank you. Let the record show a quorum is present. Okay, we have two bills today. The important thing about these two bills is they're both by members of our own committee, and they both overwhelmingly passed through this committee last year as well as the floor. So we expect a good meeting, an efficient meeting, and but we'll have plenty of time for the long, drawn-out ones, and I don't expect this one to be one of those. And Vice Chair Moraitis has been gracious enough to let Representative Spano present his first bill. House Bill 277 relating to public school facilities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I may present seated at the table, would that be fine?
Sure, it's fine.
Thank you. Thank you. Good morning, members. I'm pleased to present this bill, as the Mr. Chairman just referenced. The bill passed out of the House overwhelmingly and out of this committee overwhelmingly last year. I think it was, the vote was, if I'm not mistaken, 113-3 on the floor of the House last year. But I happen to be an advisory board member on the Camp Christina YMCA in Riverview, Florida. So the YMCA and you know, what they stand for is really important to me. This House Bill 277 would actually open up opportunities for play and exercise for kids and adults, actually, all over Florida by making it easier for schools to reopen the fenced playgrounds and courts and fields by essentially removing the cloud of potential liability. It also allows for the schools the opportunity to enter into joint use agreements with third parties in order to make those facilities available as well. By providing, again, the school protection from potential liability. And essentially how it does that is it raises the medical, or I should say the negligence standard, not the medical standard, but the negligence standard from a simple negligence standard to a gross negligence standard, which is much more difficult to satisfy. And so, in essence, provides additional protection from liability. These facilities are paid for by taxpayers. In many instances, they're in areas of town where there are no playgrounds and facilities for kids to play. And as we all know, it's important for kids to have exercise and the problem that we have with obesity. So also want to make very clear this bill is permissive. It does not require school boards and schools to open their facilities. It merely encourages them to do so by increasing that negligence standard. Hopefully as a carrot to encourage them to provide access to their facilities to kids that need it. So I would encourage your support of this very kid-friendly bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Spano. Any questions, members? Representative Hager.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Spano. Just a couple of points of inquiry. One is, and you've mentioned this in the opening comments, we considered this bill or a substantially similar bill last session, and you indicated it passed the House nearly unanimously. I presume it failed in the Senate in some fashion.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, it did.
Okay. I guess that's obvious. The next question I've got is, this seems extremely constructive, extremely positive in terms of simply stepping up the liability hurdle as a way to maximize use and access of these public facilities to our public. So what kind of resistance could arise for such a constructive view, consideration?
Well, some of the things that I've heard, and you know, respectfully to the folks that have expressed these concerns to me, I don't obviously think they're valid or legitimate, but one of the first concerns is that the language of the bill itself was a little broad and left some ambiguity as to whether or not it would actually increase that standard across the board for schools in all instances, but I think the bill makes very clear that school activities, school-sponsored activities, we're not changing the medical negligence standard for those types of activities. And to make it absolutely clear, I've agreed to actually provide an amendment at the next stop to even further clarify, just to satisfy any possible concern about that issue. Another issue that's been expressed to me of concern is that, and I don't really fully understand it, but as it's been expressed to me, that we already have enough lawsuits and we're just concerned that we're going to have more lawsuits. And I don't understand that unless you assume that maybe some of the school boards are going to feel compelled to do this by pressure from their communities, right? If, even though it's an option, their communities are going to press them to do it. And that's, I guess, what we're doing this for, right? We're trying to encourage them and press them to open the facilities. So those are the two concerns I've heard.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
You're welcome. Any other questions, members? Representative Saunders.
Thank you, Representative, for the explanation on the bill. I'm not an attorney, and when I was reading the analysis, there obviously is a big distinction drawn between negligence and gross negligence. Can you just explain what the new threshold would be and maybe provide an example of what negligence would mean versus gross negligence?
Yeah, I'll try. I may have to get some backup from some of our
any attorneys in on this committee who want to jump in?
But essentially, to show simple negligence, you just have to show that a reasonable person should have known of the danger, or that they acted in a way that wasn't prudent for a reasonable person to act, that proximately resulted in the injury to someone else. That's the simple negligence standard. The gross negligence standard is higher. It says it's got to be really serious. It has to be a gross misapprehension or gross some type of failure to act or action that then resulted in the injury to a third party. So simple negligence is a reasonable person should have done something differently, should have known the potential for harm. Gross negligence is, wow, they really should have known that they should have done something differently. I mean, that's kind of the best layperson definition I can give to you.
Representative Pasadomo is not going to critique your chops there, Representative Spano.
Civil justice chair here, guys.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. You're just dying over there.
I think Representative Spano really did capture it with that last comment he made, and it's really gross negligence sort of borders on reckless conduct, if you think of it in that sense. It's not quite the reckless standard, but reckless disregard standard, but it almost is, and so it's a matter of degree, really, but I think he hit the ball out of the park on that last answer. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very, very gracious. Thank you. Follow-up, go ahead.
Representative, you mentioned that in the next stop that you'll have an amendment. My question was going to be related to the drafting issues that are articulated in the bill summary and specifically the appeals process and the constitutional problems that may come from that. Is that what your amendment will be addressing? And if so, if not, can you talk about those drafting issues?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, it wasn't specifically what I was mentioning earlier, but I'm glad you raised that question because we've been talking with committee staff about those two issues, and we've agreed to withdraw those two provisions from the bill. I don't think they're necessary. Frankly, I think they got added in the Senate at some point along the way with someone who had a personal issue, and not a personal issue, but something they'd experienced, and they wanted the – I don't think it's critical for the bill. I don't think it's necessary. I think it weighs it down, and certainly if it's a concern, you know, with regard to constitutionality or – effectiveness or actually working with the policies that are in place, we don't need it. So, yes, we're going to remove those two areas of concern along with additional clarification about what our purpose is and our intention is behind the limited scope within which the negligence standard will be raised. So those three issues will be addressed at the next stop.
Okay. Any other questions? Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, just in the hypothetical aspect of things, if someone is hurt playing a sport through a clinic or something that had rented a field, would the liability would not then fall on the school? It would be, and are these, you know, are they being held to a standard to be insured for those liabilities in this bill?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, it wouldn't give absolute protection from liability. So if an injury occurred and the plaintiff could show that the action of the school board or the failure to act was almost reckless. It was grossly an error or some kind of a misunderstanding or lack of action, maybe to protect. Let's say, just for instance, an example. Let's say there's a hole out in the field, you know, small hole that someone's, you should know. If you're aware of that, if the school facility janitor or whoever is, that's the groundskeepers or whatever, know there's a hole out there, and you know that you're going to have some folks, kids coming onto the park that weekend to play a flag football game or whatever, that's gross negligence. You know the hole's there. You can't even see it's there, but you step into it. So in that instance, you would still have liability potentially with the school board. That may rise to the level of gross negligence. Now, what I want to clarify is that the third party, right, that may be entering into a joint use agreement with the school board pursuant to this bill, they still have liability. We're not changing the negligence standard for those third parties. You see what I'm saying? And so the language of the bill also includes provisions that says if the school board wants to, within their joint use contract, provide for indemnification or certain amounts of liability that they have to carry to enter into this joint use agreement, that's permissible. In fact, probably would be encouraged. I would encourage them to do that.
Follow up, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the school boards or districts will be then required, if these are, some of the facilities are closed or have been maybe, so they'll be required to check them and make sure that they're up to the regular performance standards of the that would maybe take that liability away. So is there some expectation that would occur?
Sure. I think generally they do that already. I mean, you know, they have kids, you know, on their facilities all the time and on the grounds, and so they already do that. You and I have an obligation, right, to act in a way that protects, you know, the public. We can't act negligently. So, yes, I mean, in that respect, the school would continue to have a responsibility to ensure that their grounds are safe and that they don't pose an unreasonable risk to third parties.
Okay. We're on to testimony on the bill. We have several appearance cards in. First up is David Francis from the American Heart Association.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Members, thank you for bringing up this bill this year again. As Representative Spano said, I do want to make clear that we are not mandating anything to the schools. This is a choice for each school to make individually based on their community, how safe they feel it is for their community to open up these grounds. And if they choose to do so, then they will receive the higher protection. As to your question, is defining negligence, the way I've been told is it's the difference between being a fool and a darn fool. One, you should know, and then the other one is you knew and you didn't do anything about it. So, but as you know, the American Heart Association supports this bill wholeheartedly. We have an obesity epidemic that we're facing, and this is just providing opportunities for kids to get outside, be active, and, you know, get healthy. Thank you very much, and if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Representative Metz, you want to comment on that analogy? Next up is Todd Rosenbaum from the Florida Alliance of YMCAs.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Members, thank you for your time. On behalf of the YMCAs of Florida, we appreciate your consideration of this bill. This is an important piece for us in our efforts to reach out to underserved communities, access resources, and bring kids together into supervised programs where we can provide a healthy environment. Thank you again for your consideration.
Thank you. Mr. Brian Pitts.
Thank you very much. Brian Pitts, Justice Jesus, on this particular measure. As you know, this bill has been floating around, I guess, for three or four sessions. It hasn't been attempted to make, for reasons obviously on the Senate, which a lot of those issues have to do with civil justice, which when this bill goes there, obviously the sponsor knows he's going to have to deal with some issues from a legal standpoint. So I'm not going to deal with civil justice issues. Sticking to education, the next aspect, well, I looked at this, and, you know, what's the need for the bill if they already can do it with interlocal agreements? Not because I said it. Staff makes it very clear on page 2, and it says, some district school boards currently authorize through their interlocal agreements public access to sports and recreation facilities on school campuses. Okay, well, that saves me time as a legislature, because if they're already doing it, they're kind of already being encouraged to do it. It's just moving kind of down the line in their discretion, letting local government decide what they want to do when they want to, using the interlocal agreement process. So we go to the language, it encourages. And it does. It says encourages. But when the legislature makes a statement, usually it's a command to change something that needs to be fixed. And when it's said to do, you want them to do it, not encourage them. And that's what lawmaking is for. So to encourage them, you're putting a law on the books to be there that hopefully it might or may not be used. No, you don't have time for that. You're here to make laws that is going to make a dent and do something for someone. So if you want to have them do it, then I would say make them do it versus encourage. It makes you say, well, how far is this bill going to go if you're just encouraging them and you're spending this time on it, on the floor in different chambers to commit? Let's have some meat to it. Again, that's besides the point. They can do interlocal agreements. Then let's go. It talks about on page 63 to 65, and staff brings this up too on page 7. It talks about grant criteria. Is that money, or is that just a general word grants? Because it said grants. So now we come to a different issue, which is procedural or orientation, which maybe the chair want to take up, that the bill may need to be referred to an appropriation committee anyway. Because the next part comes as is the entity still going to be subject to litigation? Yes, it is a possibility. Again, appropriations committee is going to need to be required to look at it, even if it's speculative, because they still can be sued. Where is that money coming from? That scoreboard. That's money. The grants, that's DOE, that's money. So hence, I'm saying, Mr. Chair, that since there's no appropriations committee to refer to, you have to talk to about it somewhere. So might as well the first one bring up the issue. There's a money tag on it. Now, I'm knocking staff's aspect as the way the bill is because of its courage. But now we got another problem. If they do decide to take it, now it's beyond courage. It doesn't matter because you're still mandating that DOE do something, whether the encouragement is moved on to the school district or not. Remember, it says in here the DOE, not school district. DOE has to do several things. The joint use agreement, the grant criteria process, that DOE must do when you pass this law, whether any school district ever does it. Now we have another problem. Doesn't DOE have enough to do right now that you legislate to them to have them do something like this, which already through interlocal agreement, it's already working itself out throughout the state. Don't give DOE, from an education perspective, anything extra to do when they really don't need to do it. Who cares if it's in existing resources? If they don't need to do it, they trying to deal with other stuff. You know what I'm talking about. The class size, the other curriculum, state standards, all this, and now you want to shove this in. Oh, when you get a little bit of time, DOE, no. They don't need to be doing this because it's not necessary. At this point, I think, the obesity. Well, y'all put phys ed, that's one thing that deals with it. FDA is dealing with diet changes in schools, and soon we'll, of course, be dealing with that. Not only that, the U.S. Surgeon General has several programs like Walk America, things like that, dealing with obesity. So if you're trying to use what we're doing just to deal with obesity, there's already things and better solutions for that to actually deal with that nowadays. Especially if you take up the U.S. Surgeon General's perspective, which this state has not done yet, that would be dealing with the obesity factor. So that's not grounds to even do this as well. So with that, you've attempted this bill several times. I don't think at this rate is needed. And thank you very much. Not to put it down, but I think there's other important issues, especially if you're trying to deal with the obesity issue, that this can be dealt with. And again, here's the one last thing. Why would you tell local through DOE how to best fit? Because remember, when DOE produces this criteria for the grant and for the joint use agreement, you're kind of now removing from the school districts their way of how they would like to do the program or agreement. So the old concept, though local governments use it for the concept of home rule concept, let's say home rule for school districts. If they want to do this, the interlocal agreement is there. Now to have DOE, once they're beyond encouraged, now they're locked in to this user agreement, and now, DOE, you must follow this. You must follow this grant. Now you're removing it from them where you actually the sponsor say, well, no, we just want to give them some room and encourage them. Actually, that kind of wouldn't be encouraging them. Matter of fact, in the school district, I saw that. Incognito, I'd be like, I'm not falling for that. Actually, that's a carrot going the other way. I'm not encouraged as a school district. But thank you very much, legislature. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pitts. Next up is Brittany Birch from the Panhandle Area Educational Consortium. She waived in opposition. Okay. That wraps up the testimony, and now members were in debate. Anyone wishing to speak? Okay. Representative Spano, you're recognized to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just really briefly address some of the concerns. The grant section, Mr. Pitts references, being removed, that's not an issue, will not be an issue. So there will be no fiscal concern. It won't. It doesn't have to be referred to appropriations in any way. I think he also mentioned there's no need to do this. There's nothing that would encourage, but in fact, the increased standard, we talked about that, the negligence standard will, in fact, encourage folks to do this. When I was a kid, we had a school that was really close to our house. In our neighborhood, all the kids in our neighborhood, we'd go there probably 2 or 3 days a week after school. We'd play football, basketball, and I rode by there a couple of years ago and was surprised to see the entire school fenced off. None of those kids can go there and play. Well, I don't know what I would have done if I was a kid and there was not an opportunity for me to go to that school ground and play basketball or play a game of pickup football or something. That's not what we're trying to do. This is not overly complicated. It's pretty simple. It's permissive. We're just trying to do whatever we can from a legislative standpoint to encourage schools to open their grounds so kids can get exercise. Nothing more to it than that. Would appreciate your support. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Representative Spano, having closed, Kaylee, can you call the roll?
Chair Beleka.
Yes.
Representatives Ahern.
Yes.
Bracey.
Yes.
Diaz.
Yes.
Hager.
Yes.
Jones.
Yes.
McGee.
Yes.
Metz.
Yes.
Moraitis.
Yes.
Pasadomo.
Yes.
Saunders.
Yes.
Spano.
Yes.
Stone.
Yes.
By your vote, show House Bill 277 is reported favorably. Congratulations. Okay, next up, it's deja vu again. We have another bill that came through last year again with, I believe, unanimous support coming through this committee, something that Vice Chair Moraitis worked very hard on last session, and it's maximum class size, House Bill 319.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, and again, as I said last year, we're not changing the Constitution. We can't change the Constitution through a statute. The class size limits are in the Constitution, as is the primary responsibility for funding class sizes with the legislature. And as you'll see in the excellent staff analysis, the legislature has put in nearly $3 billion a year over the past several years to help these school districts achieve class compliance. And so, again, for those that help get the class size amendments passed, you should be happy that there's been a lot of success with that. Most school boards are well over 99% compliant with this. So what are we doing? What the problem you have is that the way the penalty is computed right now for traditional public schools is you look at every, if you don't meet class size, and why wouldn't you meet class size? Well, let's say, for example, you are at 18 students in a third grade classroom, and you're all set. And then, 2 days before school, another family moves into the district, and now you're over class size because they have a student that age. And so you're over that limit. It's too late to hire a teacher just for one student, and maybe that's not a good use of resources anyway. And so what happens as far as the penalty? And right now, you would look at every single class that you're over and add up all those students, and then that would be your penalty based upon that. What happens in that same situation if you had one class that was under by one? Should you get some credit for that in terms of computing the penalty? And there's nothing in the Constitution about a penalty. That's a statute. And so the idea is to change the computation of the penalty to a school-wide average, which is what it was for the first couple of years after the amendment was passed. We've seen some significant penalties. The school districts are trying their best. If they don't comply with class size, they have to come up with a plan. This doesn't change any of that. It's just a common sense way to apply the computation of the penalty. Charter schools have had this for several years. They compute the penalty based on school-wide average. Last year, we had nearly unanimous support. I know Representative Saunders had some opposition to it. But in the Senate, we were only able to get through changing the computation of the penalty for public traditional schools of choice, such as magnet schools, which in our area is about a fourth of the schools. But, you know, we're not satisfied with that. We want to change it and give the maximum flexibility for computing the penalty to all schools as a matter of fairness and a matter of using resources wisely. And so that's the bill. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Members, any questions? Representative Hagan.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Moraitis. As you've accurately stated, we have a contract with the people of the state of Florida with respect to class size embedded in our Constitution. And so given that, my question and I suppose my concern is, in your judgment as the author of the bill, is there anything about this proposal that starts us down a slippery slope of constantly increasing flexibility and therefore just across time beginning to marginalize the class size consideration, which is sacred, if you will, as articulated in the Constitution? Thank you.
Vice Chair.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Hager. And I had this similar concerns, and as a, you know, my superintendent, Runcie, who's doing an outstanding job in Broward, and we've done, he made huge strides in, you know, nearly 100% compliance. And as he said, if your whole scale not compliant with class size in every single classroom, then you're not going to, this is not going to help much, because most of your classes will be over and you're not going to meet the average and you're still going to impose a big penalty. So this really does not, in my opinion, open up the gate to not comply with class size, because you still have the school-wide average in terms of the penalty. And as the staff analysis notes, if you don't meet class size, you're still not, a school district is still not complying with the Constitution and still has to implement measures to achieve class size compliance in all classes. Again, this is just about the computation of the penalty.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
And Representative Saunders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rep. Moraitis, is there anything different in this bill than last year? Have there been any changes?
There was one change, which was to, at the request of one of the school districts, was to, right now, the penalty, if you look at it, it's you know, every single student, you look at that, and then you take 100% is the penalty. Under current law, in the past several years, it's only, you would basically take that, and then you give a 50% discount. I guess it was supposed to be like a phase-in type of thing. This next year was scheduled to go up to 100%, and so we basically are leaving it at 50% for the penalty computation. So it reduces the penalty, and it would have gone up as far as that part of it goes, but we're leaving it at 50%. So it's not a change in what it is today. It's a change in what was going to happen if we hadn't done something.
Follow up?
Go ahead.
Somewhere in the analysis, it said that 2012 to 2013, there were $27 million in fines. You may not have the answer to this question. Maybe somebody from the department here would. But do we have any sense of how many fines, if this were the law today, would have been leveraged? Like, what's the difference in fines that will be levied?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't have that. I could maybe perhaps ask the staff to help with computing that.
Any other questions, members? Okay, we have several appearance cards in. First up from my own school district, Orida.
Good morning, Chair, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Iraida Mendez-Gartay, Assistant Superintendent for Miami-Dade County Public Schools. And Miami-Dade County Public Schools supports House Bill 319. And as the sponsor mentioned, it revises the calculation of the penalty associated with noncompliance to be at the school-wide average, as well as it reduces the calculation of the penalty. Currently, school districts lose the categorical funding associated per student, as well as half the base student allocation. Next year, it's scheduled to go up to the full base student allocation. So in today's world, we would lose in excess of $4,000 per student, because roughly the base student allocation is $3,800 per student. Miami-Dade County Public Schools makes a certainly a yeoman's effort in meeting class size reduction. We have met the class size reduction at 99.7% this year. Last year was at 99.6%. And when you look at the numbers, okay, because this is about ensuring that the monies that are appropriated to our school districts remain in our classrooms, right? Last year's penalty at 99.6% compliance, our penalty was $1.2 million. That would escalate to 2.4 based on the loss of the other half of the base student allocation. In this year, at 99.7% compliance, we are estimating the penalty be close to $1 million. So you round that up to $2 million based on the cost going up. Meeting the class size reduction is not always in the best interest of families and students. For example, if you have a family of three that just moves into your school in your neighborhood, and you have room for one or two of those three students, but not the third, and we potentially could have to, if we were at 100% compliant insurance, we would have to split up families, which is not the intent, and school board has a long policy of making sure that families stay together. Class size amendment has worked as envisioned in Miami-Dade County Public Schools. On average, our class sizes have been reduced by over 10 students per class. Rigid limits without flexibility can disadvantage families and students. So therefore, Mr. Chair, members, I ask and I urge your support in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much. John James Sullivan from Duval Public County Schools.
Duval County waives in support of the bill.
Thank you. And Tom Serra from the Consortium of School Boards.
Waive in support, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And they keep coming in. Vernon Pickup Crawford from Palm Beach and Collier County School Boards.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be very brief. Both Collier and Palm Beach meet class size. This is not an issue of seeking relief. It's one of fairness, and I think Representative Wright has expressed it to where we're wanting to have the same degree of consistency and accountability for all public schools, and this bill does that. And we thank you, Representative, for filing this legislation.
Thank you. And last up, Brian Pitts.
Thank you very much, Brian Pitts, Judge Jesus. Well, for many years, we've been trying to deal with this. Well, you hear the sponsor, you know, you actually wouldn't need this bill if you didn't have penalties at all. So you don't have penalties at all. Of course, the real aspect of this bill is you're trying to work around the class size that's embedded in the organic document, I mean, Constitution. So the thing would be is, then why don't you spend time selling the Floridians that it needs to be changed or changed with breathing room? You've tried it for years now. We've been through four or five speakers now, not four or five, at least three and a half speakers trying to deal with this. There's no need for this particular bill here because the real reason is you're trying to deal with what many seem to be the impossibility statewide of fulfilling class size amendment, because population changes, culture changes, age brackets, this is a retirement state. You cannot really forecast based on organic provision how to really do that. So that means you got to take it back. You should have a House joint resolution here today to give you some breathing room. What is the problem? Okay, now. So you need a constitutional resolution. You won't need this bill. Stop trying to manipulate with calculations and formulas what you know ultimately at the end of the day is going to take you back to the Constitution again. You'll deal with it, try to deal with it, then you're gone, somebody else will come here, get elected, try and deal with this instead of, look, as lawmakers, you don't want to waste your time, you don't. So what will really solve this so we can move on to other issues? Changing the Constitution. Or something that you probably won't want to try, you may want to petition Supreme Court for impossibility under all writs or through the AG. And then the court can construe for you an interpretation of the existing language and give you breathing room. So maybe you want to take that up. If it's that impossible, apply a petition to the court. You know, it can be done through the AG or all writs. And they can reconstruct it to say, okay, there's a degree of possibility. It needs to be breathing room. They also represent the citizens of this state holding their office in the judiciary, and then maybe you don't have to do the joint resolution. They can give you a construction where it can fit whereas, you know, a court would do an express or implied construction. And an implied construction would mean there's a problem with it as it expressed, but if we balance it with other things in statute, we can work it like this. I'm very sure the citizens would be fine with that, and their real original language would be left in the Constitution. And then you'll solve their problem. So with that, if you don't want to deal with penalties anymore, just get a resolution or petition the court across the street, and this problem will be solved. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, members, that brings us to debate. Anyone wish to debate? Representative Saunders, did you have a change of heart this year? Well, about to find out.
No, I didn't. And actually, I just wanted to explain that. And I'm. It's weird. I'm not often not with my school board people, but I can't get there on this one. And you know, when Representative Moraitis shares that 99% of school districts are in compliance, and then even Miami comes up and says that they're very, very close as well. That to me is actually an argument for why we shouldn't be pulling back from something that seems to be working. I understand the challenges that are coming with it, but well, for one, I'd say I think this bill goes too far. I mean, to not just tackle the school-wide average issue, but to even start an attrition of the penalties is an extra problem for me this year. And I just think if we were to pull this issue today, that the public would be really clear on where they are. That and a further attrition, you know, we went after charter schools, then we changed the schools of choice issue, and now to go after traditional public schools, I don't think the public would be there with us as we make this choice. But I understand the concern, and I think in Broward we've heard that there are some really unique challenges. Last year there was really passionate testimony from Broward on this. So I won't be there today, and I'm glad you brought the bill, but can't vote for it.
Any other debate? Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And since the Constitution didn't really require any penalty and we put one in anyway to force compliance, so to speak, I find this to be a really good bill in order to provide some relief for those that you know, would have to pay and are trying or struggling to be compliant. I mean, we don't want them to put up some more portables to put kids into in order to comply or seek to comply. And I like the you know, some of the constitutional, you know, possibilities of reform. But again, since we have it, it's ours to deal with, and I think this makes a good step in order to provide that extra relief for the districts money wise. Thank you.
Any other debate, members? I'd like to thank Vice Chair Moraitis for bringing this bill again and working so hard. As a parent with children in the public school, I've seen the chaos of the first couple of weeks of school trying to get the right amount of kids in the right classroom. And furthermore, when some of those schools have different choices and programs in different individual grades. For example, in our school, there was a Spanish immersion class that was very popular. But if you had one child too many, they were not able for that class, and the next classroom over might have 10 kids or 14 kids. And so this is not challenging the Constitution. It's just using a more common sense way to calculate by classroom average, which really gives the districts the flexibility they need and without taking away from the responsibility they have to meet their constitutional obligations. So with that, Representative Rice, you're recognized to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the concerns. I appreciate the support as well. I would just say that but we're definitely not here to debate the class size amendment. I mean, that's in the Constitution. There have been efforts to repeal it, and you know, not successful. I would agree with Representative Saunders. I would say most Floridians want, you know, class size limits. The question is, what happens if you don't meet them? I mean, and yet you're 99-point-something% there. Should you take $1 million, $2 million out of the classrooms and put it somewhere else? Is that what you'd want in your school district? And you know, I'd have to say the answer would be no, I wouldn't. And, you know, I guess I just kind of leave it there. As far as, you know, changing the Constitution, I have really no interest in doing that. This is a statutory penalty, as Representative Ahern said. This is not something in the Constitution. I think there should be accountability for achieving these things. No question about it. I'm not for scrapping the entire penalty-based system. But it needs to be, as the Chair said, a more common-sense way to compute it. And so with that, I ask you for favorable support.
With Vice Chair Moraitis having closed, can I please call the roll?
Chair Beleka.
Yes.
Representatives Ahern.
Yes.
Bracey.
Yes.
Diaz.
Yes.
Hager.
Yes.
Jones.
Yes.
McGee. Yes. Metz?
Yes.
Moraitis?
Yes.
Pasadomo?
Yes.
Saunders?
No.
Spano?
Yes.
Stone?
Yes.
By your vote, show House Bill 319 is reported favorably. Thanks, everybody, for a productive, efficient meeting. With that, Vice Chair Moraitis moves that we rise.